morning, good afternoon, good whenever you are, sinners and choosers. Welcome to Choose Your Own Religion. My name is Joe. Thanks again for tuning in. Thanks for the first time if this is your first time. This is a show where, I mean, it might be self-evident from how you heard about it or from reading a description about it, but this is a show where I interview other comedians about whatever religious background or spiritual experiences or spiritual practice or what they even think about the word spirituality is. We talk about all that kind of stuff, and sometimes we make up religions, sometimes we don't. I'm really energized today. I'm really energized this week, this month. I can't lie to you guys. November was an insane month for me, an insanely good month. November 2017, one of the best months I've had in such a long time. So much has happened in that month. A lot of it was spurned on by I'm like not drinking, I'm not smoking weed anymore. That's great if you do one of those two things, but I will say I do feel a lot better doing that. I'm eating healthy. I'm bragging about how good I'm feeling, but I'm trying not to too much because I'm so overjoyed, and I just want to share that joy with you guys. And more importantly, as far as this podcast go, we're getting close to episode 100, which is incredible, mind-blowing. I don't frankly know how it happened, how I got to those over the course of the past 2 years, but we're getting there. We're almost there, and I'm really excited for the next 100 episodes, feeling so energized and so called to put more of my effort into making this a product that's not just about what I want it to be, but what you guys want it to be, what you guys need it to be. And so please keep the lines of dialogue open for what you like about this show. Email me, jojoquinn.net. Just tell me, you know, say what's up, say what's going on. Reach out if you're having a hard time or if you're having a great time. I would love to hear from you either way. That's joe@joequinn.net, or, you know, find me through Facebook or some shit like that too. It's also great. My guest today is Katie Dawson. I loved today's episode. This was the last episode I think I recorded before November 2017, but I was still even already, you could feel me feeling a little bit better. And partially it's because Katie is an amazing human. She's got an amazing energy. She's a storyteller and a comedian, and she had a great story to tell me about her time in a Tuscany meditation center farm place. And one reason I still do this podcast is it still fascinates me to hear all these different stories. And Katie's great. She's wonderful. Follow her, Dawsonator, on Twitter and I think Instagram as well. And see her when she's performing in LA. Highly recommend it. And other than that, you can go to chooseyourownreligion.com for old episodes. And if you're listening to this far in the future, I think I'll have some other cool content on there by then. Thank you for an amazing past 2 years. And I know I say it, and sometimes it sounds like I don't mean it, but I truly do love you. And more importantly, the universe loves you. You are loved. Wherever you are loved. And you don't have to earn it. You never did. You are loved. And hold that in your heart. And make a little space in that heart for Katie Dawson.
Allow the soothing music and uplifting affirmations to center your heart and mind in an awareness of God's love.
Wake up, my dear sinners. Wake up from your deep rest. Won't you say your prayers? Know that you are blessed. I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I hope that you choose your own religion.
Closer.
Better, yeah.
Okay.
But cool. You can like pull it. It's, you know, it's not fragile or anything. You can.
Right, move it around a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
But whatever. Hey.
Hey, how's it going, Joe?
Good. Thanks so much for coming. I know relatively not much about you because I just saw you do my show at the Copper Still. I saw you tell a story.
Yep.
Wait, was that Aaron that you know?
So I know some people who have done your show, so I submitted, but I apparently know Aaron. I didn't remember until I saw her again that night. But we did boot camp for like 1 or 2 days together.
So it wasn't like an awkward thing like, oh, I remember her, but she doesn't remember me. It was just you didn't realize you remembered each other.
Exactly.
That's much more comfortable.
A lot more comfortable. I was like, I just didn't know this was your show and I didn't like know her full name. So sure, I never really put it together. So
because the worst feeling is when somebody recognizes you and you're like, I definitely don't remember. And you're like, hey.
Yeah.
And that's happened to me a lot with like some improvisers who have like done the show. And I don't like, maybe I'm, I don't know, maybe it's more, I don't know, I guess it's more, I'm more memorable only because I'm telling stories and it's like just me versus like they're part of some troupe. So I'm not like hearing their name and I'm not necessarily seeing them as an individual.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know. Or I'm just excusing my own bad etiquette, I guess. But.
No, I mean, I do that all the time. I also have this thing where I, like, don't wear my glasses all the time, and I should. So, like, I'll meet people and then see them around and, like, not realize it's the same person because I'm not wearing my glasses.
Wait, can you take your glasses off real quick?
Sure. So I can see you, but if I probably wouldn't recognize you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, from this far away.
Oh, so you're saying you wouldn't recognize them, but they would still recognize you without glasses?
Yeah, without glasses.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. But I'd feel like I'll walk right past, especially at UCB, right? You would just walk right past people, and people would be like, you just walked right past me. I'm like, I couldn't see you,
I promise. Yeah. Yeah, because I was like, well, you look similar-ish to with glasses.
I feel like I look the same.
It wasn't like, what's like the classic movie one?
Like She's All That, Rachel Lee Cook.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. Or Superman, you know. He's,
right, more iconic probably.
He's All That, including a superhuman being thing.
It's the same gag.
Yeah.
Same gag.
Same tired gag. I do also love like that feeling of UCB Sunset in particular. I always get this. Like anytime there's a show, like way that people are like lining up outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever walk by, I like look at the line and almost everybody like looks to see who's walking by just to like see like, oh, do I know that person? Do I know that person?
Yeah.
It's a weird like.
I hate having to go to class when there's like a line out front. You just like feel everybody look at you and then like turn around disappointed.
Yeah. I don't even want to be famous. I just want people to think I'm famous. Like just strangers to think I'm famous. They're like, oh, that guy, I think I've seen him somewhere. I think he's been in something.
Yeah. Oh, he looks really familiar to me.
I should get to know him. You know,
just read. So I take public transportation. Just read a script on the bus and people will start pointing at you and like gossiping. And it's like, yeah, I'm a famous person on the bus.
You're an LA bus rider, huh?
I am. Yeah, it's a rarity. I am a diehard bus fan, though. I drove here today. I borrowed my boyfriend's car, but we're like a one car household.
Sure. Well, that's I guess if you have at least one in the household, then for days like today, it's not like. So out of the way.
But you actually are in a fabulous public transit location here.
The 81 stops right there.
Yeah.
The Gold Line.
The Gold Line.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love me some Gold Line.
I love the trains in LA, like the Expo Line.
All five of them?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. I lived off the Expo Line for a little while. I was obsessed with that train. Mm. Oh, I love that train.
But how long have you been in LA now?
Well, so I grew up in San Diego, but both of my parents are from LA. So we used to come up a lot to visit my grandparents and cousins and stuff. I went to college in LA. So that was from 2004 to 2008.
UC.
UCLA. Yeah. I guess USC, whatever.
I kind of wish people would just call UCLA like UC when they're in LA. Like, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to start that movement.
I like that. Yeah.
It's like, oh, you went to UC?
You went to UC? It's weird because Cal has Cal, right? Like,
yeah.
And you can call Cal and everybody knows what that school is. But like every other one, you have to say UC and then the state or the city or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fair.
Or they'll say Riverside. They'll say Irvine or something. And you kind of know like, oh, I went to Irvine or I went to Riverside. But you can't say I went to L.A.
Because there's literally only one college in Riverside. Right?
Right.
I guess there's probably Cal State there now, too.
I don't know. There's some other places.
There might be. Yeah. That's fair.
I don't even have, like, a mental image of what Riverside looks like. I know I've, like, probably driven by it at some point going to, like, San Diego, I guess. I couldn't tell you anything about Riverside.
It's just, like, strip malls. So I grew up like just south of Riverside, but my dad's family runs a floral wholesaling business, and so they had a warehouse in Riverside, and for a summer I delivered flowers, so I used to have to go up there at like 4 o'clock in the morning.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so I spent way too much time in Riverside.
So you were telling me in your story that which is the only context I know you from that you at some point, was this after UCLA, that you went to Tuscany?
Yeah, so I graduated in 2008, and my senior year, I had been doing a lot of, I focused on transcendental literature as an English major, and I was reading a lot of Emerson.
Like,
and
I was
Thoreau,
Emerson, Thoreau.
Whitman.
Am I a massive hack for every time I go camping, I just, like, and if I'm by myself, I'll take a Walden with me. And just because that's the only book I want to read, like, you know, I'm like, I'm gonna be away from nature, but I kind of want to read something, and then I'll just feel like such a, you know, naturalist intellectual.
I don't think so. I prefer Emerson, but Thoreau is very funny, I think. Like,
oh,
Walden is very funny. It's a very funny book. And it's funny because I went this last summer to the East Coast with my boyfriend for like a little road trip, and I also felt very hacky because we were in Massachusetts, and I was like, I really want to go to Walden Pond.
Oh yeah.
We did.
How is it?
It's so cool. I mean, it's funny because like you realize how close to Concord he was. He's only like 20-minute walk from Concord. It's like a 5-minute
yeah,
drive.
Yeah,
it's like nothing. Like, he can easily get to town, so his whole idea of like, oh, really out in the wilderness,
life in the woods,
it's like kind of fake. But it's cool because they have like the way that they figured out where it was is they like used Walden and Walden Pond, and then found like they found just the foundation parts of his old house, so that's how they know where it was. And there's something about that that's like really cool to me. It was like,
that is really cool,
right? Like, they had to kind of put the pieces together and like, oh, this is the woodshed from the woodshed chapter, and like that stuff, and you're like, oh, cool.
And he built that thing for like $20 or something, like in his money. His day's money.
He loves to talk about how little he spends on anything, how little he eats. That's like his MO is like, oh, aren't I awesome.
Yep. I mean, to be fair, he was pretty awesome.
Pretty awesome. Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Wait, what Emerson should I read if I haven't read any Emerson other than what they assigned me in high school?
On Nature is like your starting point, right? So that's kind of the core. So he had his own sort of philosophy on what existence is. And that idea to me of like somebody in the 1800s being like, this is what I think existence is so weird because there was already so much religion and so much kind of established thinking on it. And for somebody to just be like, I have a completely different idea of what being is. And you're just like, that's kind of cool.
That is. So that's what kind of drew you when you were in college, was like studying that kind of.
Yeah. And a lot of Emerson is very heavily influenced by, you have like the like Locke and Rousseau, and like that, a lot of that also sort of he like pulls from them, he pulls from Zen philosophy, he gets his is very much a mishmash of like different things, and he kind of comes up with his underlying concept.
Well, he either was a Unitarian, or he's like now the god of Unitarians or something like that.
Is that true?
I don't know if he actually, I can't remember if he actually was himself a Unitarian Universalist, but he for sure is like, transcendentalists in general are definitely revered in that, from what I, the handful of times I've gone to like a Unitarian service, that's, and from Unitarians I've talked to, that's the impression I get, is that, because it's, you know, it's all about, correct me if I'm wrong, but transcendentalist literature and that whole movement was about, you know, naturalism and being the spirit of the direct contact with nature and not having other, like, it's not about like whatever theology kind of man has written into history, but it's about like, being that direct experience.
That commune with nature, right? And so Emerson had this his underlying theory, which I think is so fascinating, was that we all are individuals, but we all exist, instead of God, he called it the mind. So we all exist within the same mind. We're all a part of the same quote unquote mind. And each of our individual minds is like, just like its own sort of offshoot of that. But that Mother Nature exists, because metaphor is the perfect form of language in Emerson's opinion. Mother Nature exists, and nature exists to show us like metaphorically more about human nature. So when you look at like the patterns of nature, like the seasons, and how we easily write metaphors about that, the seasons being a reflection of human existence or the human lifespan, his whole thing was like, right, that's intentional. It's because all of this is just designed to explain our internal experience to us, if that makes sense.
No, it does. Yeah. No, I love that. And I was thinking of, we were talking about Alan Watts before we started recording, and, that's something that there's actually an Alan Watts passage kind of talking about what about what draws us to nature and what draws us to animals in particular is like they're not self-conscious, right? So they're like a bug is just doing bug stuff. He's not like questioning like what's the meaning to be a bug, what is like
why am I carrying this stick, what right. is like the end purpose of my life here,
like yeah. they don't have like sexual hang-ups, you know, they're not like questioning like, oh, I don't even know if I should be into other bugs, you know, that's not really my thing, you know. So that's what's like so fascinating to us on a very visceral kind of level when we're out in nature, and that but then by nature of our own then we get into like what's the whole nature of consciousness kind of conversation, but to avoid that for the time being, yeah, you just for some reason the way our mind is, it's it causes that reflective, that self-reflective sort of like it can end up being a series of loops of just mirrors looking at each other, and that's right. what can cause like well, fucking psychosis, frankly.
Sure, yeah, it's just like that like just constant like self-examination, which and yeah that tunnel.
Well, that's like something I have struggled with a lot before, is this idea of rumination being a negative sort of I guess extension of reflection. So you can be like, yeah, self-reflection, good thing, being like self-aware, like taking inventory of your actions and your intentions, all good stuff. But then totally. The rumination is like that going overdrive, and just you never, it's analysis through or paralysis through analysis, where you're just like trying to over and over just be like, I can't think of the right thing to do. And that is definitely a function of mind that, you know, dogs don't have. Those bastards.
Yeah, totally. I think that mine was, I think that I've always, ever since I was young, I remember having that feeling of like, oh, I wish I were just like an animal so that I didn't have like this constant self-doubt, this like nagging like, are you right? Like, what's wrong with you versus other people? You know, all that things, those things we were just talking about, mm-hmm. that animals just are so lucky they don't have.
Yeah. So, but anyway, so you were into transcendentalism, and then...
So I was, yeah. It was my senior year of college, and, you know, just a couple of things like I had going on. I was taking a lot of like psychedelics at that point in my life, and was getting kind of heavy into like some harder drugs that mm-hmm. like my own parents have a history with. So I was like, okay, I should, you know, be very careful here and be very aware of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And
were you reading like Arrowhead or anything to like get like...
Wait, no, what is that?
Do you know Arrowhead? Well, I have a history of some psychedelic use too.
Okay.
Arrowhead is like by the way, if you are into psychedelics, anybody out there, go to arrowhead.org, and it has a history, or not a history, it's a huge kind of archive of general information about every kind of psychedelic and non-psychedelic, you know, stimulants and every other kind of like chemical you would be interested in putting in your body. And it has like the sort of repository of you know, both academic articles and like actual research done on the actual science of the drugs, and also has a list of like user experiences of like, oh, this was my, I had a bad trip when I did this, this is with that, whatever. Anyway, so you didn't do that. I've gone down that road before, but anyway.
This was 2007.
Yes, maybe not. He was either not around or was just like,
yeah,
just starting up around then.
I feel like, I mean, the internet was a thing since I was in high school, like a usable thing you could like Google and stuff right. like that starting around then. But it was still like, by the time I was in college, like graduating college, the viral video hadn't really existed yeah. yet, or it like was in its very, I think the very first one was like Shoes in 2006 or whatever.
Yeah. The internet was still in like middle school.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. yeah. The internet was like child's play compared to what we have now. Right.
Yeah. yeah.
So I didn't do a lot of research. I did. I mean, I read like Timothy Leary, right? I read like the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, and
sure.
I was like, Tom Wolfe, cool. I got it. I know what I'm in for.
Yeah.
And I still like psychedelics, and I have this thing where like, I kind of go back and take LSD like once every few years. Mm-hmm. If I find it, if it's around, somebody offers it. Just cause I think that one's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I had 5 or 6 years ago, I had a bad mushroom trip, and it wasn't even bad like in terms of what it mentally made like affected me, but I went a little bit off the rails in terms. I have a whole thing about it, but basically I was in Malibu Creek State Park and got separated from my friends all this stuff. That's the most vanilla version of that story, but that shied me away from taking it for a while. But I have, let's say in recent months, been getting more back into LSD a little bit again. I love how it, there's just something about it there's a million things about it that are great.
So good.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm amazed that you were like, I would not have been brave enough to take in any of these without like doing way too much like research or way too much like it's amazing that people did it in like the 70s and 60s
when there was nothing about it.
Barely anything. Yeah. and when Timothy Leary was like just barely around, they're like, we don't even know if we like this is a legit guy.
And they had no idea how to dose it and right. or what a dose was. You right. know what I mean? So you could take like one dose of acid and then the next day take one dose of acid and they'd be completely different amounts because there wasn't right. like a universal for
standard.
That at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so you were in college doing this.
Doing this. Yeah. And I kind of knew that I couldn't stay in L.A. because I was in L.A. and all my friends were staying here. And I just, you know, I kind of like I had a bad attitude about things. I thought I was like too cool for stuff. And I saw that happening because I used to when I was younger, I was like a really enthusiastic person. And I feel like as I got older, I got more jaded and I sort of was self-aware enough to be like watching it happening. And I realized that like I was going to have a lot of trouble like entering the working world and being like an adult in the mindset that I was at that point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was worried about hanging out with the same people, doing the same shit, you know, graduated college. It's fine when you're in college, but
no, I get that. Yeah. Yeah.
So a friend of mine I was living with, she knew some people who had gone through WOOF, which if you're not familiar, it stands for like Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms.
Okay.
And
oh, yeah. You were mentioning that.
Yeah. So it's like it's a pretty cool system. You sign up for a country. They send you a list of farms for that country. And then you independently contact the farms and say, hey, I want to come work on your farm in exchange for room and board. Here's the timeline I'm thinking of. Do you have space for me? So I, instead of like getting a job, I was like, okay, I didn't study abroad in college. I'd never been out of the country. I'd been to Mexico a couple times, but that's because I'm from San Diego. But other than that, I hadn't done a lot of traveling. So I was like, it's time for me to, you know, kind of spread my wings. And also I loved the idea of farming because I was like, get my transcendental Thoreauvian experience
yeah.
in here, get off the grid a little bit.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, there is something like, at least to people like me, there's something very seductive about that idea, even of like, oh yeah, I'm gonna join a fucking was it like a co-op situation or?
So it's just like you go to farms that have like a place for you to stay, and all the farms tell you what the situation is. Like you'll either be sharing a room with other farmers, or you'll be in a tent or whatever the situation is. They
yeah.
tell you. And it was just like, yeah, like and Italy is cool because Italy, especially then, was like super off the grid. So they didn't really have iPhones, and like Wi-Fi in small villages was like not a thing. You know,
yeah.
I was like in these tiny little like medieval villages that are outside of major cities. And there are places where they don't speak English at all. And where there's like no Wi-Fi and
wow.
like where the price of something changes depending on where they think you're from kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah.
Like that stuff. And I love that stuff. It just was like so cool to me. It felt so real.
It's like living in an analog world again.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah. There was one village I went to where we were crossing the train tracks in a car, and we had to stop. And this guy walks out of this little hut and comes out to this crank, and he starts cranking down the bars to
mm-hmm.
lower it for the train to go by. And that's like still a job in some small village in Italy to like, he's like comes
the
out
train crank
the train
guy.
Yeah, the bar crank guy. And that's his job, and he like hangs out in this hut all day. It was really bizarre, but
yeah,
I like Italy has still got this very, when you go to like rural parts of it, it's still very provincial, it's still very small town, it's not hugely technical, there's
mm-hmm.
not, you know, internet access.
Would you do something like, not even that one specifically, but like how does that the idea of going completely off the grid now like sit with you?
So it's hard. I go back and forth with this, as I'm sure you probably do, and I think a lot of people who are creative types who like want to be working in an industry. Like I love comedy. I want to be a comedy writer, and that is here. That's very much so here, and it's hard mm-hmm. to do that elsewhere. But there's this internal struggle I have where I'm like, but wouldn't it be great to be like the fire watch person in the mountains? Like, yeah. you know, McKinley, oh, yeah. Mount McKinley.
100%.
The yeah. one guy in the fire watch mountains all winter long, mm-hmm. you know, because that was, mm-hmm. that's totally a job too, actually.
Yeah.
That's still a job.
Yeah.
So stuff like that. Yeah. And I have that sort of like, I know I need to be here, but the longer I'm in LA, the more I get that.
That
desire,
urge.
Yeah.
The like mountains are calling again. And I must go, yeah. you know?
And it's hard because I'm in a committed relationship now. And that's one of those things where it's like, before I would have just like been like, all right, cool. I'll just go for a month. And now I'm mm-hmm. like, oh, I can't like, do that.
Yet another, the old ball and chain for real. I'm sure he's a great
No, he's person. Fabulous. Yeah, he's fabulous. And if there was anyone I could say like, hey, I'm going to take off for a month and go hang out in the woods. He's the one who'd be like, all right, cool. Have fun. Bye.
He wouldn't see like, oh, me too. He'd be like, no, peace.
Oh, hell no. Yeah. He'd be like, cool. I'll just be home playing video games when you go back.
You're like, oh, all right.
No, I kind of like it. I mean, like, you know, we're very different people, and it's like learning how to like get the things that you want. Well, because you never, I think that I in my head I was always like, oh, I'll date somebody who's like an adventurer, and then I'm in a relationship with somebody who doesn't like being outside that much, and it's like, oh, okay, this is interesting. How do we?
Yeah.
But he's, you know, it's just as long as he's cool with me doing it, then it's fine.
Yeah. I mean, there's certain, you know, I think. As somebody who's single and trying to only date people that I could, this is my rule is like now, this is not definitely not always been my rule, but I'm like, I'm not going to even go on like a first or second date with somebody if I don't think I couldn't imagine a universe where we were together like long-term. Like, I'm not saying I want to marry every person I like go on a date with, but like, I could at least theoretically see myself being with them until, like, you know, you date them for a while. You're like, oh, it's not going to work out for whatever reason.
Sure.
But there, so yes, there's like a certain amount of like, you might say like disqualifiers or something that, you know, that we look for in people, or you're like looking for people who are super compatible. Like, oh, it's great. They're a comedy person too. That's like, mm-hmm. and which I've done that. And then you break up and then you see the downside of like, oh, that person's now in my scene and I have to like
oh,
see
yeah.
them. But then in my whole point being like when the chemistry is right, it seems like a lot of the other things can just, you can work with a lot of the other
100%. Like before yeah. he and I started dating, I would have been like, oh, I could never date somebody who plays video games ever, because I'm not into it. Yeah. I don't like being inside that much. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, then I'm dating somebody who's like upset, who like once is a game designer. And I'm like, okay, well.
You dated the ultimate video gamer.
I know, yeah, exactly. I'm like, oh, I had no idea I'd be okay with this.
Yeah.
But it's certain things like, you know, he, like when I want to go out and do shows or mics and stuff like that, he doesn't care that he's like, that he's home alone, because he's
yeah.
doing the thing that he loves. And
sure,
so,
yeah, yeah. So it works.
It works, yeah. Because I've dated people before who like they feel neglected, especially with comedy, because your nights is
yeah.
when you do your shit, right?
Yep. Yep.
So. It's hard with non-comedians, I think, because they like are sensitive about the fact that you're never around and blah, blah,
yeah.
blah.
I mean, and I dated somebody who was that became a major issue. And I was like, look, I was like, I love you. And I'm like carving out as many nights as I can to hang out with you. And I get like 6-7 nights a week might be too much for a lot of people. That's probably not even what I don't want to be out literally every night of the week. You know,
right.
We all need some time to recharge. And it's there are some people who their idea of a relationship, and it's not better or worse, it's just not compatible with mine, that they want people who are like, yeah, we're going to watch TV most nights. We're going to hang out. Like, we're just going to be hanging out with each other most nights. And I think probably the majority of couples are like that, if I'm not mistaken. So then it can be tough when you're like, yeah, I'm going to be out for a while.
Probably going to be gone like 5 nights this week until
yeah.
2 a.m.
Yeah.
So, 6 mics.
So you're right. It does. That's definitely one of the things where you're like, you need to either be an independent minded person, or you need to also have your own shit going on that
yeah.
you're not bothered by that.
Exactly. Yeah. So it wound up being, it shocked me more than, and my cousins too. My cousin, when she met him, she was like, I never really saw you as somebody who would date somebody who plays video games. And I was like, me either, dude. I don't know.
That's great. So anyway, you're in this, you're in Tuscany.
So I'm in Italy, and I worked on a couple farms before I wound up at this meditation center. I worked at an olive harvest, and then I worked at a bed and breakfast. And then the third place I went was this meditation center, and I knew nothing about it. I just knew that it was a meditation center with an organic garden where I would be working.
And you're like, in, sold.
Yeah, I was like, that seems great. It's in the middle. It's in Tuscany. It was like right smack dab between Pisa and Florence. There's mm-hmm. like a train line that runs between those two cities, and it was right in the middle. So it just seemed like a perfect location.
Sure. And had you done any meditation before this?
So, not really. I had tried. So this person who told me about Woof, she was into meditation, and she would meditate in our apartment. And I tried meditating with her once, and it's something that had always interested me theoretically.
Right.
Right.
Like a lot of people.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I was like, that seems cool, but maybe not for me.
Less stress, more focus. Yeah, I'm into it.
Yeah, but, oh, I have to, like, sit and
do nothing
for a while. Yeah. What? And it was really hard at first, you know, because all of the things that they say, like, your mind is just, you have to kind of train yourself to quiet your mind. Yeah. It's really hard.
Well, that's a meditation practice, right? That's
exactly. Yeah, that is the meditation practice for most people. So I didn't really know anything about it. But, yeah, I was interested in trying meditation. And when I got there, I didn't know anything, you know, because every kind of school of meditation has every meditative school has their own school of thought, right? Mm-hmm. So I didn't know what theirs was. And I had never heard of it before. So in California, and I think, you know, you get a lot of Buddhists and, you know, sort of Zen thinkers. And there are a couple meditation retreats here that do the, like, Vipassana meditation, mm-hmm. which is one that I always wanted to try but never did. But I had never heard of this before, and they don't have a name for their meditation, but their guru it's kind of like Prince. He had like three names. Mm-hmm. so when he was alive, he was like Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, mm-hmm. and then something happened, and then he was like the guru with no name, basically.
Wow.
And then after he died, they posthumously named him Osho. So...
Oh,
do you know Osho?
I've heard of Osho, yeah.
Yeah, so Osho has a small following in the U.S. right now, but he has a very large following in Europe. It's interesting to me.
That's going to make it the dumbest joke.
Do it.
How many would you say he has, like, one less than 12? Like, he would have Osho's 11? Okay, that was, I'm sorry. Why did I stop that conversation?
Osho's 11?
There's no reason to stop that conversation with a dumb joke.
I'm sorry. Good puns are anyway. Always worthwhile.
I don't even know if I agree, and I just made one. Anyway, so Osho, minor hit in America, big hit in Europe.
Yeah, we were talking about Alan Watts, and so mm-hmm. his whole thing was bringing Eastern meditation to the West mm-hmm. In the 60s when hippies really wanted that, and there was like a big push, mm-hmm. People going to meditation centers in India. It was like a whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he saw a marketing opportunity, but sure. I am sort of cynical.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think this is that, unlike most, I think, meditation gurus or Zen philosophers, he really wanted his followers. First of all, he believed in having his followers, which, right? Yeah. Yeah. That is not a Zen thing. Mm-hmm. So he had his followers, and if you wanted to be one of his followers, you had to wear this like these orange or red robes. Like, they all wore these things, and he gave you a new name. You had to give up your name and let him give you a new name. And that was your sannyas name. So his mm-hmm. followers called sannyasins.
Okay. Well, I've heard of the idea of a sannya being like a community, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So he had his sannyasins, and the money opportunity. So his whole thing was, he was like, don't give up your jobs, don't give up being in the world, keep your good paying jobs, stay in the world, make your money, because we need people like you. He was like, I need you out in the field, kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But he also had 99 Rolls Royces that were bought for him by his sannyasins.
Wow.
And like a bunch of different, every video he does, there's a different Rolex watch, like stuff like that.
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah, stuff where you're like, this is clearly, does nobody else? All right.
Am I crazy?
I'm the only one? Yeah. Okay. I'm the only one this bothers? All right, I don't get it.
Yeah. Did you get a sense that other people picked up on that, or you're like,
only other people like me, only other woofers, everybody else in the center, because they all justified it the same way, which is he never asked. That's their whole thing. They're like, he never asked for anybody to ever give him a cent. Well, which is hard to argue, well, right?
Yeah, it's hard
to argue that. It's like, well, I guess if people are just volunteering that money, there's not a whole lot I can say about it.
Sure.
But how much does brainwashing have to do with it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Anyway, so, and also just like, he would say things like, oh, it's fine for me to own all these cars because I'm not attached to them. Like, you could take them away from me tomorrow and I wouldn't care.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his whole thing. It's like, fine for you to have all the money in the world as long as you're not emotionally attached to it.
Yeah, well, let's put that to the test then.
Right, you know? Yeah, exactly. Well, like, let's see, then get rid of them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's weird because, like, there's something we just inherently... I guess we pick up one with like somebody who's claiming to be, you know, immaterial being so material. And at the same time, I mean, do you know who Chogyam Trungpa is?
Oh,
started Shambhala kind of around the same time, 60s, 70s, riding that hippie wave.
I think I've heard of him.
He brought a style of his own teaching of Buddhism that was similar in that, well, one thing he talks about is avoiding spiritual materialism, which is this sort of, I mean, we can boil it down, TLDR would be like self-righteousness, right? You know, spiritual righteousness that Jesus railed against. I think most spiritual, whatever your strand is gonna be like, yeah, don't think you're the shit spiritually. But then he would, you know, he would be like, oh, so I, like, he would drink and he would, like, you know, smoke cigarettes. I mean, he would kind of go crazy and have like lots of sex and that type of thing. And there's something always about that you're kind of like, you don't quite trust. You're like, you feel like they should be beyond that or above it. But at the same time, I can see the counterpoint of that too, where it's like, well, if you're trying to make yourself above or beyond certain things, then you can get a certain spiritual materialism. You get like that, you get in your head about like, oh, I'm now you're elevating something else, whereas they were sort of about zeroing out everything.
You start keeping tallies of the good, your good things, right? In the same way that people will tally their material possessions, you start going, you know, well, I am this way, or I meditate this often, or
a holier than thou.
Yeah. So it's one of those things where you're like, okay, I want to not be bothered by this, but it always really bothered me.
Yeah.
But that said, so and people will ask me like, well, why did you stay there so long? Because I definitely did feel like there were cultish aspects of the place, which I talked about in that story, and we can get to. Mm-hmm. But the thing that really kept me there was the meditation. So he created his own meditation style, which was designed to reach the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
And it operated under the premise that, like, Westerners are so surrounded by media and distractions just constantly, television, billboards, ads, that it's more difficult for us to quiet our minds because we are so just constantly bombarded.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't even know what 2017 looked like.
Oh, I know. This is in the 60s. He's like, oh, it's commercials. And you're like, oh, if you knew what now
is. I mean, this is like, I mean, they talk about it all the time, the attention-based economy now, especially online, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's something I'm learning. I'm doing a sketch writing thing for CBS right now, the Diversity Showcase, and they've talked to us a lot about, like, you are writing for people who will stop paying attention in 2 seconds if you don't grab their attention.
Yeah.
So it's harder for us, suffice it to say, it's harder for us theoretically to enter into like a meditative state and to quiet the mind. So he created a meditation style that is most of his meditations. There are a few different ones, but they're typically 2 hours long. The first hour is dedicated to physical activity, and then the last hour is dedicated to sitting in silence. And his theory was that if you wear yourself out, then you won't like have the energy to get distracted when meditating. And it really worked. I mean, it worked so well. It's like meditating training wheels, to be honest.
Yeah. No, I that makes sense to me a lot. Wait, was the first hour, was the physical activity like, all right, go to Wells Fargo, extract a couple $100 and then bring it back here and then just put it in front of you and then just sit in silence. Yeah.
It should have been. I would not be surprised.
No, but I was, there's this, dance movement slash it was a I took it as a class, but they meet, the one I went to meets every Sunday in Culver City at the Masonic Lodge. It's called Five Rhythms, and it was really cool. It's basically like a free form dance movement. I'm trying to best to describe. I can't remember what the five rhythms are, but it's like there's like it tries to categorize all dance movements into like staccato dance movement and lyrical and chaotic and stillness, and then there's one other I can't remember. But the idea is that you go through, like, over the course of an hour, you cycle through each of these five, like, you know, there's no talking, there's no instructing, but it's just like you're just moving with your body and you're getting in touch with it. And so it's a style of meditation, but it also does have the benefit of quieting your mind after a while, because yeah, you are physically like worn out.
Totally. Yeah. Osho also felt that dance is a form of meditation.
Okay. I'm actually, you know what? Strongly. I'm into this Osho guy, actually.
It's surprising. So this is why I stayed. I stayed at this place for 8 months. I was only supposed to be there for 1 month. That's how long our agreement was for. And like around week three, I was like, can I stay for another month? And they were like, cool. Then around, like, you know, towards the end of that second month, I was like, can I stay for another month? And they were just like, you know what? How about you stay as long as you want? And you just tell us when you want to leave.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
It was great. I was really close with the owners. Mm-hmm. They were really sweet people. It was just like I was doing a lot. I could feel myself doing a lot of self-work and sort of, I think, undoing some of the bad things that I did to myself in college by just like becoming disconnected from people and withdrawing interactions with people who were different from myself and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved it. And you know, it's hard because like I really do think that it's kind of a cult and that Osho was probably a terrible person. But it's hard to deny that like some of the things he did were good and helpful, especially for me.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, somebody people shit on a lot is like, you know, Joel Osteen of like the Houston megachurch prosperity gospel type person. I mean, he, in terms of being like a materialist, he's up there too.
For profit.
Right. But at the same time, it, obviously thousands of people go every week because they get something out of it. You know, they get some kind of benefit to their emotional well-being or else they wouldn't go. So
yeah.
it's a weird, it is always a kind of a... Yeah, what's are you doing more harm than good? I don't know. It's hard for me to judge.
Yeah, that one's harder for me too.
It's even harder. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you were staying for 8 months.
So I stayed there for a long time. And at first it was just like it was very chill and everything was super chill. Did you want me to talk about the stuff that I addressed in my story?
Yeah.
So the weird thing about this place started to occur around like the third month that I was there. And I became slowly aware that they were conspiracy theorists. Like the owner particularly was just a diehard, like deep web fucking conspiracy theorist. He spent all his time online. And it was so weird because like he was such a meditative guy and he was so happy and like so sweet and so jovial. But then he would just go nuts about chemtrails. And like he watched Alex Jones.
Wow.
Yeah, it was weird because I didn't know who Alex Jones was. This was 2009.
Yeah.
And the owner of the center talked about Pedophile Island, which at that time was like, I don't know if, do people know about Pedophile Island?
I think that's where like Jeffrey Epstein kinda...
and Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and like all these other top politicians supposedly have.
Yeah.
Like there's like an island just with children that they fly to sometimes to
something
have
like
sex
that.
With children.
Yeah.
Which don't you think if there were like an island full of we would like really know about it? It wouldn't be some dark theory.
I mean, they tried to tell us in Pinocchio that place was a real place.
Yeah.
Know? They tried. We didn't listen.
We didn't buy it. Yeah. Maybe we aren't just not paying attention.
You know, maybe I'm not nearly as woke as Alex Jones after all. Definitely possible.
Oh yeah, Alex Jones, the wokest.
Mm-hmm.
The wokest.
So he's getting like is he like preaching these things? Is he like, oh yeah?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Oh yeah. Like, well, you know, he'll talk about Hillary Clinton is a lizard person. Like when this was Obama was president and he liked Obama. Like Obama didn't, you know, he didn't really believe a lot of the Obama conspiracies, I think, because he liked him.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone else, he was like more than happy to believe that Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton did these horrible things.
Uh-huh.
And then chemtrails was a big one. The world ending in 2012, the Mayan calendar thing, that was huge for them.
So they thought the world was going
to
end.
Oh, they were ready for the end of the world. They were like, that's part of the reason they got that center. And there was a guy that they were friends with who would come to visit, and he had his own compound in Brazil that he bought over the largest underground crystal in the world. And he bought it in preparation for the end of the world because he thought that, like, that's where he was going to be the safest.
Uh-huh.
Over a crystal, obviously.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, they were very, and actually that person in Brazil, like, it didn't occur to me, but I, just a couple years after this trip to Italy, was going to Brazil, and I, like, messaged him and was like, hey, I'm gonna be in Rio.
Uh-huh.
Like, you should come hang out. And he's like, when are you gonna be here? And I was like, December 20th, 2012. And he was like, I'm not gonna be leaving my property that week. And he kind of left it at that. And I thought, I was really offended by that message. And I was like, can you believe this? He's like, not gonna leave his house to come meet us in Rio. And my friend was like, doesn't he think the world's ending? And I was like, oh, that's right.
Yeah. Then you were being the offensive one.
I know. I was just like, oh, come on, hang out.
Yeah, come die with me.
But there's part of me that hopes he feels real. He felt really dumb when the world didn't end, and then he missed the opportunity to visit me.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what's always, I always love to know, like, the first church service or whatever after the world doesn't end with any, like, doomsday group.
So I've heard about this, though. I think, I can't remember where I read this, but I read something about a group that had predicted the end of the world and then it didn't end when it was supposed to. And apparently they went back to the meeting and the guy was like, oh, I did the math wrong. And they just, like, created a different date. Like,
yeah. And they're like, oh, okay.
Oh, wrong math. Carry the two.
I can't believe we didn't, you know, quadruple check this thing that was the basis of our entire lives.
Totally. I mean, because they would do it, like, I think the guy was like, they counted up the number of bricks in the pyramids, and it was all these things that they'd use to kind of calculate when they thought the end of the world was going to be. Mm-hmm. And then obviously it didn't end, and they were like, oh, maybe it was this thing. And
I mean, if it ends too early, too, you're just going to be pissed, too. You just were not ready for that.
Dude, you have to let me get home to my crystal first.
It's the biggest in Brazil.
Come on, man. It's what I bought that property for. Mm-hmm.
So you were, like, starting to not feel it, basically.
Yeah. I mean, there were just things that, so, you know, like, most of the time with conspiracy theories, you can just, like, write it off. And there definitely was, like, a small part of me that was like, what if the world does end?
Sure, yeah.
So you're surrounded by it. You're surrounded by it. And you start to think, like, oh, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they are right.
That's amazing how, like, social I mean, you were talking earlier about how you needed to get out of L.A. to get out from your friends at that time. And,
yeah.
You know, but there actually is maybe some truth to that, because we are so affected by our immediate local social environment in ways that we think, like, I definitely think I would be above that. I'm like, oh, I'm not going to be affected by, like, working, let's say, like, at a hedge fund. And I'm like, I'm not going to be affected by, like, you know, that kind of philosophy in those people. But then you just start, like, slowly transforming a little bit. Your personality shifts a little bit.
Sure, yeah.
Your lifestyle choice. You're like, I'll go along. If they're like, oh, let's go out to, you know, do 1% things. And you're like, yeah, I like the 1% now.
Actually, I had a similar experience to that when I came back from Italy. I worked in the tech, and I, like, fell into working in the tech industry a little bit. But mm-hmm. I was living in, like, a cheap apartment with an artist friend of mine in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got this job, he was so angry with me. He's like, you're fucking one of them now, dude. And I was like, no, I'm not. I'm not. And then I just, like,
and you wrote a blog about it.
And then I was, like, going to Napa every weekend. And then it occurred to me, I was like, oh, fuck, I am this dick. Yeah. I am this douchebag. And that's, like, more or less when I quit and decided I wanted to come down here and do comedy.
Oh, there you go.
I have a good tendency to, like, almost fall into a cult and then be like, oh, no, I gotta get abort, abort, abort.
And then just fall right. And then now you're taking UCB classes.
UCB classes.
Now. Yeah, it's, hate to say it, but.
I actually have a bit about that where I try to, like, make parallels between Scientology and UCB, mm-hmm. like the famous LA cults.
Sure, yeah.
The two.
I mean, it's something I joke about it too, not really as a cult, but, like, I hear a lot of people, especially in comedy circles, you know, make fun of frats or whatever. Like, oh, you're just, like, paying for friends. I'm like, well, that's what, like, UCB is too, right?
Sure, yeah.
That's, like, half of the reason. It's like half of what you're paying for. It's like, oh, I have good friends now.
It's great though, right?
Yeah, it's great.
And there, I mean, I love improv, and, like, you know, everything can be weird or amazing depending on how you approach it, right?
Definitely, yeah.
And that's kind of how I felt about this place. I was like, I can either let this be very weird or just kind of enjoy the ride and be here and be in it and be part of it. While still trying to like maintain my sanity and independent thought. But so yeah, they were ready for the end of the world. It was very bizarre. It was super bizarre. And then when I came back and learned Alex Jones in the context of the 2016 election, I realized the way I figured it out was, I have a very conservative family, and mm-hmm. my uncle posted a Pedophile Island article from Breitbart on his Facebook. And I was like, oh my God. I guess apparently if you go really far left or really far right, you like wind up meeting somewhere in the middle of right. this like crazy town.
Yeah, like the horseshoe theory that I'm talking about. Where no. it's that same idea where politics is not on a straight line. Like the continuum of politics isn't on a straight line, but it's a horseshoe. So if you start if you picture a horseshoe, you know, the centrist people are in that middle connecting part,
right?
And then in the immediate outsides, they get farther away, but then as a horseshoe curves back in, so does like the far right and the far left. They
right.
curve back and actually become more like each other.
Yeah.
I mean, some people are like rolling their eyes at that thing, but there is some, I think there's some maybe truth to that. Is what you're talking about.
This, I mean, from what I could see, it was right. It's like, if you go, cause in either case, I think for both my uncle and for the people at this center, it's more just a distrust of the government. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can be right or left and just not trust the government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in fact, the farther right or the farther left you go, the more likely you are to think that like, oh, this is all a lie. And
yeah, well, there was a James Comey of all people, they found his like Twitter account. Did you see this?
No.
He had like a secret Twitter account that had like five posts or something, about five, but it was called like Reinhold Niebuhr, which is a theologian, a famous like Christian theologian. And he posted something a couple weeks ago that just like as soon as the I think it was when the first Mueller indictments came out.
Oh yeah, that was just like last week, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, by the time this comes out, maybe it'll be. But yeah, anyway, at some point he posted a quote from Reinhold Niebuhr, which was like, I'm gonna fuck it up. But basically, it's like we need like democracy is something that we want because of like the best intentions of man, but we need because of the worst side of man or something like that.
Yeah.
I just totally butchered it, but you get it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, my boyfriend and I talk about this all the time with like the far right. I think the conservative ideal of the world relies on human beings always being on their best behavior. In a way, like I think that for like a limited government world to really function, mm-hmm. everyone has to kind of be on the same page that they like will, you know, mm-hmm. behave accordingly, even without constant regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think that's true. I just don't think that we have earned that trust.
Yeah. It's interesting. Cause I see what you're saying. I think, conservatives would probably almost say the opposite, which is like liberals are too delusional about how good people are. They trust the government too much.
Oh, we trust people to not abuse a system.
Right.
They don't trust people to not abuse the system, so they just rather not have a system.
Right. They trust the idea is like if we're all like encourage selfishness, I guess, in a certain way, then outcomes end up being more optimal than if we try to curb selfishness too much. But
sure.
I don't know. I don't know who's right. I have my own political stuff. I obviously, if anybody talks to me for any length of time, you'll realize I lean left for sure. But
yeah.
I don't know. I feel it's hard for me because I can see the, I believe what we've lost a lot in this. I'm going to sound like I'm on like the Bill Moyers or something, or what was that one PBS show, the McLaughlin Hour? Whatever,
oh yeah.
Whatever it's called, the McLaughlin Group. Is that what it's called?
The McLaughlin Group. Yeah.
Like in this country, I think the problem in this country is that, I think we don't even like what we've gotten to is that. But I feel like before, even if you weren't a conservative, you could see like, oh, I philosophically understand what conservatism is about, and I can see how you could believe in that. I could see how that's like a believable point of view, and the vice versa. They'd be like, okay, I'm not a liberal, but I see where they're coming from. Now it's like, we just demonize the whole like oh, you have like, there's 50% of the people are just wrong. They're just wrong. And I don't fully believe that, but
I don't either, actually. And I should say, like, I shit on conservatives all the time, but I also shit on liberals.
Yeah.
I mean, like, we all have, like, every side has its flaws, right? But I do agree with you. And actually, this conveniently takes me back to talking about Italy. They have very little regulation in a way that I was kind of obsessed with while I was there. So, for example, when you do the olive harvest, every village has a frantoio where, you know, because basically every house, they have their own olive trees. So people will harvest their own olives and then take it to like the local frantoio to make their own olive oil for their own house. And like most Italians have like their own fresh olive oil just sitting around.
Sick.
Pretty amazing, right?
Yeah.
But so you go to this frantoio and it's just like a factory where you bring your own olives and then they process it through their machines and you pay a fee. You either give them a percentage of your oil or you pay them for it. And you get to just walk around this factory doing your own shit, right? Like dumping your own olives in and like it's going through a processing machine and then people are hovering over the processing machine, still pulling out like sticks and leaves from the olives,
yeah.
Like as it's being processed by these like teeth.
Yeah.
And you're like, my hands are like right next to these teeth and nobody's stopping me. And then I'm like wandering around these machines and there's olive oil over the floor and there's like no caution signs and nobody's like, oh, don't step there, it's slippery. And there was something about that that just was like, yeah, I mean, right, because if I get hurt, that's on me because I'm here and I mm-hmm. should be aware of my environment.
Personal responsibility.
Exactly. So there are those things where I do empathize with conservatives on certain things where I do feel like there's a lot of hand holding that mm-hmm. happens in this country mm-hmm. as far as stuff like that goes. And, you know, you'll go, like I went to a park in LA and there was like a thing that used to be an interactive sculpture and now it's fenced off because somebody fell off and got hurt. And you're like, yeah, well, fuck that guy. Like,
yeah.
what did he
right.
do?
Right. Yeah.
Now this is ruined for everyone.
That sounds like it was a cool factory. There's something very to get back, it's sort of it's back thing going back to like transcendentalism. It's sort of a more organic form of living. It's a more, you know, again, an analog form of living. You know, back in hundreds of years ago, they didn't have those. That would have been what it would have looked like.
Yeah, exactly. And it's cool because like the farm or the frantoio is run by an older Italian gentleman, and then his like 9-year-old son, who definitely should have been in school, is running the forklift. You know what I mean? You're
yeah.
like, what? And it's like that kid's not gonna go to school. He's probably not gonna get a formal education, but this is the family business. Like he's being trained in what mm-hmm. he's gonna do for the rest of his life.
And he will know the shit about. Olive oil.
He will be an olive oil master, right?
Yeah.
It's very cool. I mean, like, it's tragic that he's not going to get an education, but there's almost this like kind of cool thing to just like watch like a parent be like, well, you don't need that because this is
yeah.
our family stuff. This is what we do.
Yeah. And if you're happy doing that, then
yeah,
then I'm now jealous.
And I mean, it was such a cool environment. Just people like, you know, making your olive oil. And then I'll never forget this. There's like a big kitchen where there's like a big fireplace. And while you were waiting for your olive oil to finish processing, people would go in and toast bread so that they could have like fresh bruschetta
mm-hmm.
and then when the olive oil would be finished, everyone would like try their olive oil
oh,
on top
awesome.
Of a piece of bread that was just toasted.
Yeah,
it's like stuff like that, you know, the charm of like provincial Italy is something that is, it does feel very transcendental. It does feel a lot more connected and a lot simpler.
Hey, you can get that at a Napa winery too. You have like some families working there too.
That's
you know?
True. Some Napa wineries, yeah. I've been to a couple. Oh man. I haven't even looked to see which ones were affected by the wildfires or anything like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, you do get, you definitely do get that family ownership up there.
Yeah.
You also get some massive wineries that just feel so impersonal and gross.
Sure.
But.
Yeah, right. So what was like the turning point that made you like bounce?
So it was a couple things. So they brought this guru in who came to talk to us about enlightenment, and I talked about this in my story at your show the other night, but he weirded me out in a way that like I started to see this the more sinister side of the where I was. And his whole thing was just, he was almost excited by these, like, so he was tracking the swine flu deaths because this is when swine flu came out. And he was kind of like morbidly excited by the fact that this was happening right? You're making this face like, ew, because it feels gross, right? And he was like excited by it because he felt like this was the end of the world. It was finally happening. And he was very excited to be at like the forefront of it and to be the leader of the next group that was going to like survive.
Oh my God.
The new world order, right? And it's very self-indulgent and like just gross.
Yeah.
It's like you're talking about real people, real lives. And this is another thing. We got in a big fight over 9/11. Because they were talking about how there were no actual airplanes. It was all CGI. I mean, their conspiracy theories go beyond inside job to like crazy town.
Wow, yeah.
Which is that there were no airplanes. The buildings were just blown up. And then all the people who were supposedly on the plane were in...
like some kind of government facility.
Yeah, protection, witness protection, yeah. Right? That was their thinking. But so a friend of mine from elementary school who moved away to Virginia... her dad was one of the pilots on one of the planes.
Oh, wow.
And they'd been a big...
Holy shit.
Yeah. So they'd been, really active in the church in the town where I grew up. So we had a service for him. And I was sitting at this table listening to them say that, like, there were no pilots that on these planes or anything. And I was just, like, seething. Because I was like, then what the fuck did I go to?
Yeah.
Right? You know, you're like, then what service was that? Who are these people that are crying over their loss? You know what I mean? And
yeah.
It just felt so self-indulgent. And it was like, you guys are talking about like real people and real shit.
Yeah, you're just talking out of your ass.
Yeah. And you don't know any of this. You're just making this up. And that was sort of that. I would say that was my breaking point with the group when I kind of realized like, oh, I don't like this at all.
Mm-hmm.
But they convinced me to stay because they were like, oh, but this was in June. And I did tell them in June. I was like, I think I'm going to get ready to leave and go on to another farm. And they were like, oh, well, we know you didn't like that guy. But there's another guy coming that we think you're really going to like.
Uh-huh.
And he was like a Native American shaman from the Lakota tribe.
Okay.
And he came and did like sweat lodges with them.
Cool.
Like the Anipi sweat lodges where, you know, it's like 4 hours and however much degree temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Some people in the Southwest died from this a couple years ago.
It's
pretty intense.
It was like I don't know, the classic one, maybe it's stereotypical, is peyote involved in it? Or
no, so this center was very anti-drug.
Mm-hmm.
which I thought was really cool because like me there were a lot of people there who were like reformed drug users or had mm-hmm. been heavy into psychedelics or mm-hmm. even heroin, and we all kind of like, you know, there was this sort of mutual understanding where we were just, you know, looking for, I think that anybody who does drugs or does meditation is like, or is into nature or whatever it is, you're like seeking that more. Like, it's like, you know, there's more to this and you just want to know what that is and how
mm-hmm.
to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a cool commonality between all of us. It's like, oh yeah, we're, you know, I did acid cause I was looking for the more, and I'm doing meditation cause I'm looking for the more.
Mm-hmm. So the sweat lodge guy comes.
We're not doing peyote because, again, drug free.
Mm-hmm.
They did drink wine, though, but only at dinner because they're
sure.
Italians.
That's Italian.
But he came and the sweat lodges were great. And like he was a wonderful person and somebody that I still communicate with on Facebook. And like he really, he was a sannyasin and he was a Native American, but he was also sannyasin and like had, you know, but he didn't take it as seriously as everybody else did. He had actually known Osho. So nobody else at the center had known Osho. He'd actually been Osho's security guard for a little while in Pune. Yeah. So like this guy had been around.
He had some credentials.
He had some cred. Yeah. He was great. And I really liked him. And then I guess the breaking point for me was it was like the last sweat lodge of the summer and everybody's like getting ready to leave the meditation center for the summer and go back to their real lives. And he asked me, he was like, so when you taking sannyas, when you changing your name? He just like asked me straight out. They were like, he was like, you've been here for like 8 months. Like, what are you doing? And that's when I was like, oh, they think I'm like in it. Oh, I got to get out before they realize that I am not in it.
Wow, I am keeping my name.
Yeah, I was like, my name is Katie, and it's going to stay that way. So it was like, it was right after he left, and it was the end of summer anyway. So it's like, it was kind of had like this whole logical feeling of an end. So that's when I was like, okay, I'm going to bounce now.
Bounce, yeah. Were they, were they mad or anything? Or
no, I don't think so. They were, disappointed, mm-hmm. I think, more than anything else.
Did they like, oh, you're making a mistake?
Yep. Yeah, very yeah. much. Like, what are you going to do? I got that. Like, what are you going
to
do?
Oh, back to Los Angeles, the heart of Western civilization.
I actually stayed in Italy for another year.
Okay. Yeah.
I went abroad. Like, I went and did a hitchhiking journey through Eastern Europe, basically.
Sick.
It was tight. And that was like another like big transcendental experience, like living off the kindness of strangers and, you know, with no money. And
yeah,
it was cool.
That is cool.
I liked that. And so I did that. And then I came back to Italy and like my parents were like, okay, like I came back to Italy and I was in Rome at a hostel. And my parents were like, okay, let's buy your plane ticket. Let's get you home. And then I didn't really want to come home yet, but I didn't have any more money. And I was asking around like for ideas, like if I could get a job at a bar, because there are all kinds of things you can do to make money under the table. And I got a job as a nanny. So I stayed in Rome and worked as a nanny for a year and then came back.
Very cool.
I just was like not ready to leave. I love Italy. I love that place. And like Italians are great. And it was cool.
That's awesome. And how did your meditation practice grow over the course of those 8 months? And how is it now?
Now, unfortunately, it's non-existent. I am one of those.
Oh, no.
I know.
Totally out of the sangha.
Dude, it sucks because, I mean, I do yoga, which I try to, like, incorporate meditative practices in yoga, which is why I don't really do it in classes. Like, I do it at home. I do, like, my own practice. Mm-hmm. Mostly just because I find classes to take away the meditative aspect.
100% for me. It's, like, so distracting for me. Especially, which, yeah. like, well... There's two things that distract me. I would be a fan of doing an all male yoga class for real, because I'm like, you know, I'm so trying not to be creepy at right. any yoga. I'm like trying so hard not, but it's so, I mean,
hard
I can't
not to be creepy.
And in some ways I feel like it is, because
no,
I'm
it
like
is.
Surrounded by like 20 attractive women who are in tight clothing. And I'm like, this is not conducive to me. Like, yeah, zeroing out and focusing on my breathing. I'm really trying. Half of my focusing is like, all right, don't look in any direction. And then there's like a mirror in front of you, and you're like, well, fuck, I'm fucked. The mirror is the other thing that fucks me. It's like,
yeah, I hate the mirror.
Having a mirror during a meditation practice is like trying to diet in Ralph's, you know?
Oh, yeah. And like half the time I'm like, oh, what? That's what my hair looks like right now? You know what I mean?
Totally.
It's like
awful. Yeah. Oh, I look good. Oh, I look bad. Oh, I like, you know, I'm not doing this right. Whatever.
You're supposed to use it for the, oh, I'm not
form.
Doing this right. Yeah. Which is like, I would say, I think for most people, probably like 30% of what they use the mirror for.
Sure. Yeah. Definitely it is for me. Yeah.
Yeah. And classes, I've had teachers who just like to talk, which takes me out of it and I don't really enjoy. And also, yeah, just like being in a space with a bunch of other people, there's just something, it's like harder for me. Like when I meditate or when I'm doing yoga at home, I do have moments where I like will be in a pose for more seconds than I realize, because I just like, you know, blank out and kind of just try to clear my mind, and then I'll be like, oh, I have no idea how long I was holding that pose for. But it's not possible to do that in a class where it's like, oh, do this and then do this and then do this.
Yeah. I don't know, but I still like the classes sometimes, just because I forget like some poses. I can do my own routine if I need to, but then I tend to not hold it as long unless I'm in I'm the opposite problem of you.
Oh yeah,
I'm like going way too speedy, like 10 seconds a pose, 15 seconds a pose or whatever.
So I know this is cheating, but a lot of times I get high before I do yoga, and it helps to me to like just like not keep track of how long I'm doing any one thing.
Yeah, no,
because I just zone out.
Definitely makes sense. Yeah.
I know that's cheating. And at the meditation center, we talked about this all the time. Like, sure, you can get stoned and that feels like you're meditating, because you are clearing your mind in certain cases, but it doesn't count. It doesn't fucking count.
For me, though, I don't know if it would always clear my mind. It would, I guess it depends on what strain you're taking and how much, but it would make me more self-conscious, and it would make me more in my head, not less.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, I think also one of those things, everybody reacts differently to different drugs.
Yeah, and sadly, I'm like in another chapter of my life where I've actually just a couple days ago, I'm like giving up marijuana for a while. I don't know if it'll be forever, but it feels like it'll be a long while. I don't know. I go through seasons of life where I've been a massive stoner for long stretches, and then been completely sober for other stretches. I just feel like I'm entering another sober season. So Yeah.
It's probably good. I mean, I feel like my tolerance right now is so ridiculous that I kind of want to do a sober season just so that I can get high again.
Sure. Yep.
Tough problem to have.
Also, I say a sober season minus, I'm not including LSD in that, just to be clear.
Just weed.
Well, and drinking too, I think, for a while. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I'm figuring stuff out.
I'm not a big drinker. I was when I was younger. I loved drinking when I was like in college, but then I quit when I went to the meditation center, and like it hasn't been something that
I'm definitely hitting that age. I mean, it's the stereotypical where it's very hard, much harder to recover than it used to be.
Oh God. Too. Yeah. And like, you feel it, you can like feel your kidneys angry with you.
Yep. And you just feel gross the next day. And
even if you're not hungover, you just feel off.
Yeah.
So I don't meditate, now, but the meditation practice itself, I mean, I learned how to meditate first while I was there. I had never done it before. I'd never really had that experience of sitting in silence and, you know, watching your thoughts and not being attached to them.
Yeah.
And that's a cool thing. And I think even though I don't meditate now, I still do try to practice watching my thoughts. Like when you have a thought that, you know, because we're all, especially comedy writers, we all want everybody to like us, and we're all very self-conscious and all these things. And so I'll have thoughts where I'm like, oh, this person hates me, they hate my writing, or they don't think I'm funny. And those are the ones where I'm like, watch it, be aware of it, and
investigate,
let it go.
Yeah,
like hang out with it for a second, maybe ask yourself why you're feeling this way or what it is, and try to label it, and then let it go. So I still use certain techniques from meditation in my everyday life and that I learned there.
Very cool.
But otherwise, in terms of like, so the meditation there, it was just like very, it was also a very emotional experience. And some of the meditations used, instead of physical activity, emotional catharsis that involved like heavy breathing that would turn into crying or screaming or...
I'm into that kind of thing.
It was
that sounds cool.
It was this thing. So this it's called dynamic meditation. It's a 21-day cycle. You do it for 21 days in a row. It starts at 6 o'clock in the morning, and it's the first 10 minutes of the meditation are you put your hands in the air and you like kind of squat down a little bit, and then you just jump up and down in that position for 10 minutes.
So it's like Tony Robbins-esque kind of.
Yeah. To me, I thought it was like military training. I was like, Osho was totally getting ready for war, I swear. But so you do that and it's like very physically taxing. And then you go from that into this like heavy chaotic breathing where you breathe as arrhythmically as possible through in and out of your nose. So for example, like... really weird, like three short breaths in and then like one long out, and then just do like chaotic arrhythmic breathing. And that kind of results in like I think it's an oxygen high that creates. So you do that for 10 minutes, movement and then the breathing, and then 10 minutes of emotional catharsis comes after the breathing. And the breathing really lends itself to that emotional catharsis because you're like so hopped up on oxygen that like you, and then you're just supposed to do whatever emotion comes. So some people cry. I laughed a lot. I did a lot of laughing. There was one guy, and you're not supposed to listen to people, but also like there was one guy who would come and just scream like "Putana," which means bitch in Italian. So he'd be like sitting there in his meditation, go like, "Who the fuck broke your heart? Like, what is going on over there?"
This sounds awesome.
It's kind of crazy. Yeah, it was cool. And then you do that, and then so you do your 10 minutes of emotional catharsis, and then it was 45 minutes of sitting, and then 15 minutes of dance at the end. You do that for 21 days in a row.
Wow.
And towards the end of that cycle, because I only did it once because I hate waking up early and it was an option, like it was optional, but they did encourage me to try, like they were like, do the 21-day cycle once and then you don't have to do it anymore. And I was like, okay,
yeah,
all right. So, but towards the end of that cycle, I started having like all these crazy dreams where I was like blowing up shopping malls and like killing my parents.
Whoa.
Yeah. Like really intense shit. And like, I have a very complicated relationship with my parents, and I think like capitalism and all these things that I was escaping when I left America. And I think that there was just a part of me that was like, yeah, blow it all up.
Yeah.
That's
your catharsis right there.
Yeah. Right. It was like, I really do feel like it was the emotional catharsis process that kind of allowed my subconscious to connect to those feelings and like work through them in a dream state.
That's very cool. So you're not blowing anybody up now.
No. And the way I did it in the dream was I was like in the basement and I tied a string around like one support column and then to the next support column and then to a third support column and then just like pulled and the entire shopping mall just collapsed.
That's very creative.
Yeah, in my dream I was like, wow, that's weird. That worked.
Yeah, but it's not the hacky explosive one either.
Yeah.
Like, oh, we get it. You're gonna blow up a building.
No, it's just a couple pieces of twine. I totally fucked up a shopping mall with that.
The MacGyver of communism, you know. So we've been going for a while.
Yeah.
I guess before let's not take too much of your time. I want to just wrap things up. I want to ask, I guess, two questions. What's your advice to anybody who wants to get into meditation? What would you say?
I think I would say, one, be open-minded, right? If you're looking into meditation, you're probably pretty open-minded. Mm-hmm. But I say that because I think in my head, meditation always looked like Vipassana. Like it was always like a static, serious endeavor. Mm-hmm. And the thing that really opened me up to meditation and to doing more meditation was going in a place where it was like kind of more fun. So yeah. Osho meditation was fun. It was enjoyable. People
energetic.
It was energetic. Yeah. It wasn't totally static. Of course there were parts of it that were static, but so I think that just like being open to trying something that maybe isn't what you expect meditation to be, or, you know, just like being open to trying whatever until you find something that works for you.
Cool.
Because I think that there's this idea that meditation is supposed to be this or that. And I think just being open to finding whatever works for you is helpful.
Mm-hmm. My second question, which I realize now I don't even know if it makes logical sense. So you don't, let me first, this is now my, I have a third question. This is now my
second question.
fake second question. So you're not. You don't consider yourself Buddhist or anything. Like, do you consider yourself anything, or do you go to a temple or anything?
No, I mean, I'm an atheist. Mm-hmm. And I don't go to any temples. I've considered, and I still kind of want to do a Vipassana meditation retreat and sort of stay in the meditation community. I did look for Osho meditation when I moved out here just because I thought I'd like still like to do the meditation. There aren't any.
Wow.
Yeah.
They're gone.
There are not any Osho, but there are tons in Europe, like all over Europe. There are centers, just not. So part of the reason they might not be in America, by the way, is in the '80s, they tried to build a commune here and it went horribly and they were basically banned from the United States. So that might be part of it.
That might be part of it. Well, but then that kind of erases my last question, which was going to be, well, why don't you go to a temple? But if you don't, I mean, if you're not anything, I mean, it's,
yeah. I mean, you know. I'm
What would it take for you to go to like a church or something? Or like, what would draw you to like wanting to be a part of a community of people?
Okay. So I've been thinking about this a lot, actually. I grew up Catholic and I grew up raised in a church. And even though I'm not Catholic anymore, I still really appreciated that community feeling.
Yep.
And also, and I joke about this, but also like as a kid being forced to be somewhere that like I didn't get to do whatever I wanted, or I wasn't the subject of attention, where I just had to sit and be fucking bored and miserable and just accept that, I think is a good formative experience for children.
Yeah. So if you have kids, you'll make them go to church.
Well, so my boyfriend is Jewish and if we get married, I'll probably convert. And if I had to convert to any religion, I'd say Judaism is the one that's most intriguing to me.
Yeah.
It's like very base. It's very worldly based, right? Like, you do good works not because of heaven or hell, but just because that's what you fucking do.
Yeah. Well, what's cool is I went to I've talked about this before, but I went to a bar mitzvah, kind of an accident, and the kid, I didn't know anybody there, but the kid, when he was giving his speech, he like basically opened with talking about how he was an atheist, and everybody was like fine with it.
Yep.
And like, in fact, his rabbi was like really proud of him and was like, oh, he's like such a smart, like, you know, inquisitive type person and all that. And like, and somebody else was like, yeah, faith is for Christians. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, it's not, we don't need that. Like, you don't have to believe in God to be Jewish, you know?
So that's kind of how. So
that's the one for you.
I really do. And I really like, I think anybody who grows up watching comedy, like, there's always this weird part of me that fetishized Judaism. So I was like, they're so funny.
It was very funny, Bar Mitzvah. I will say that. People were very funny.
Yeah. When my boyfriend and I went back to Montreal to visit his family, and we went to an unveiling where, like, a family member had died, and they, like, were unveiling the gravestone. And since we were in town, we went. Mm-hmm. And he has a couple rabbis in his family, and one of the rabbis said something, and it was like his type five. I swear to God, he did his type five at this like really somber ceremony. You're just like, oh, right, because it's just everyone's got a good attitude.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Joe. This is tight.
Where should people find you? Do you have anything to plug in social media or anything? Or
Let's see. You can follow me on Twitter. Yeah. My handle is Dalsonator, Dalsonator.
Sick.
It's not a very good Twitter account. I'm really good at selling myself. And then other than that, I'm around. I'm always doing comedy stuff.
Maybe meditating somewhere. Maybe not.
Yeah.
Actually, probably not meditating, but.
I will be telling a story at the Clubhouse. Who knows when this is going?
Yeah,
out,
probably won't
yeah.
be out.
Yeah.
You'll be around LA.
I'm around. Yeah. Come find me.
Yeah.
Let's
awesome.
Chat.
Well, thanks. This is great.
Thanks, Joe. Awesome. Thank you.
That's the show. Thanks again to Katie. ChooseYourOwnReligion.com. Email me at jojoquint.net. I'm serious. Just say hey or some shit. Say something good you're going through. Say something tough you're going through. Connect. Reach out. We are in this together. That's all for now. Namaste.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?